Our scripture lesson tonight comes from 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 1 to 40. This is a rather extensive passage, and we can't do it justice, really. The trick is to know what to leave out when you expound it. So if you wonder why we don't cover some things, that's in the half hour that we left out. Now we look at the passage, though. Let's read it, if all, in order to get it in front of us. 1 Kings chapter 18 at verse 1. When many days had gone by, the word of Yahweh came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will give rain upon the face of the ground." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. Now Ahab had summoned Obadiah, who was over the household. And Obadiah was one who feared Yahweh greatly. And when Jezebel cut off the prophets of Yahweh, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and had hidden them by 50s in a cave and had sustained them with bread and water. And Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the stream beds. Perhaps we can find grass and keep alive horses and mules and not be cut off from having livestock." So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went one way by himself. And as Obadiah was on the road, why, there was Elijah to meet him. And he recognized him and fell down on his face. And he said, "Is it really you, my master Elijah?" And he said to him, "It is I. Go say to your master, Elijah is here." And he said, "What is my sin that you're giving your servant into the hand of Ahab to put me to death? By the life of Yahweh, your God, there's not a nation or kingdom where my master has not sent to seek you." And when they said, "He's not here," he made the kingdom or nation swear on oath that they could not find you. And now you're saying, "Go, say to your master, Elijah is here." Then it shall happen that I will go from you, and the spirit of Yahweh will carry you off where I've no idea. And I shall come to tell Ahab, and he will not find you, and he shall kill me. And your servant has been fearing Yahweh from my youth. Has it not been told my master what I did when Jezebel was killing the prophets of Yahweh, that I hid 100 of the prophets of Yahweh by 50s in a cave and sustained them with bread and water? And now you're saying, 'Go say to your master, Elijah is here, and he shall kill me.'" And Elijah said, "By the life of Yahweh of hosts, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it really you, you troubler of Israel?" And he said, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, doing along with the house of your father, by your abandoning the commandments of Yahweh, and you have followed the Baals and them. Send, gather to me all Israel to Mount Carmel, including the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who are eating at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent throughout all the sons of Israel and gathered the prophets to Mount Carmel. Then Elijah drew near to all the people and said, "How long will you go on hopping between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him. And if Baal, follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left a prophet of Yahweh, but the prophets of Baal are 450 men. Now let them give us two bulls. And let them choose for themselves one bull, and let them hack it up and place it upon the wood, but they must not set fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and place the pieces upon the altar, and I will not set fire to it. And you shall call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of Yahweh. And it shall be that the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people answered and said, "That's good." Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves the one bull and prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but you must not set fire to it." So they took the bull that was given to them and prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "Oh Baal, answer us." But there was no voice and no one answering. And they hopped around the altar they had made. At noontime, Elijah mocked them and said, "Call louder, for he's a god. Maybe he's thinking or using the facilities or on a journey. Perhaps he's asleep and needs to wake up." So they called louder and gashed themselves, as was their custom, with swords and lances until the blood flowed over them. When noon passed, they raved on until the time for the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice No one answering, no one paying attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. And all the people came near to him, and he restored the altar of Yahweh that had been torn down. Then Elijah took 12 stones in line with the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of Yahweh had come, saying, Israel will be your name. And he built the stones as an altar in the name of Yahweh. Then he made a trench around the altar, one that would hold about 2 seahs of seed. Then he arranged the wood, hacked up the bull, and put the pieces on the wood. And he said, fill 4 jars with water and pour it over the burnt offering and the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. Then he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. So the water ran round the altar, and the trench was full of water as well. At the time of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet drew near and said, Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, Yahweh, answer me, and let this people know that you, Yahweh, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. And the fire of Yahweh fell and ate up the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. So all the people saw and fell on their faces and said, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. Then Elijah said to them, grab the prophets of Baal. Don't let one of them escape. They grabbed them, and Elijah brought them down to the Wadi Kishon and slaughtered them there. And that last verse may send you into a tizzy because you're all concerned. You think, who does Elijah think he is, after all, to do that? And why does he have to wreck this wonderful occasion? Well, at least for readers, it's wonderful there on Mount Carmel. It's just like having a Southeastern Conference football game and being in attendance, and it's a bright October afternoon, and your team won, and you came out, and as you're leaving the parking lot, you have a fender bender, and it just wrecks the whole thing. And that's the thing. Why does Elijah have to slaughter? Why does he have to kill these prophets of Baal? Who does he think he is? So this ruins it all for you, perhaps. But you just need to put yourself into reverse and get back into the Bible. This was not personal viciousness on Elijah's part, and it was not sheer nastiness either. He was simply carrying out Deuteronomy 13. It was in the law of Yahweh. Now see, Israel was not a democracy. The church and state were not separated, and Elijah was carrying out the provisions in Deuteronomy 13, which said what? Well, among other things, that if a prophet should arise, even if he should give out some, speak of some miraculous sign, and it actually comes to pass, nevertheless, if he's a prophet who seeks to pull you away from the worship of Yahweh and get you to serve other gods, that prophet is to be executed. Elijah is simply carrying that out, the provisions of Yahweh's law. You see, Yahweh seemed to think that apostasy was a big deal. And that's reflected in the law. Now, if you still have problems with that, you're going to have to deal with it. But Elijah was simply carrying out the provisions in the Torah or the law of Yahweh. But what do we have? What we do have here is a God contest, isn't it? You see that in verses 21, 24, 36, 37, 39. It's a God contest. Who's the real God? And Yahweh was going to send rain again, verse 1, after over 3 years without there being any rain. But as Lee Corso on ESPN says, not so fast. You can't just send rain again. Why? Well, because the Baal folks would then say, oh, Baal was down, but he sort of recovered. It looked bad, but he's come back, and rain has come again. They could say that. So, because of that, you see, you have for 3 years, Yahweh, as it were, shutting Baal down, you might say, in the view of Baal worshippers. Baal was the fertility god, the storm god, the god of rain, etc. And he hasn't been able to produce. And so he's exposed Baal for the non-god he is. But to keep people from thinking that Baal might recover, etc., Baal has to be discredited. publicly, openly, obviously, clearly, in living color on national prime time. There has to be a definitive discrediting of Baal, a real put down. And so Mount Carmel's contest is important. Now, this text in 1 Kings 18 has an agenda, by the way. Don't think that it's not after you. The agenda of this text is that it wants you to place yourself in the service of the real God. And if you do that, and you keep looking at this text, there are certain discoveries that you will make about this God. Let's notice some of those. First of all, notice there's the variety of God's servants. Verses 3 to 16. The variety of God's servants. My tendency in the past had often been to go right to verse 21 into the contest on Mount Carmel and so on. But you have all this stuff, this part of the text in the first 16 verses that has to do with Obadiah, this fellow Obadiah, as well as Elijah and so on. And there seems to be a good bit of attention on that. Seems that there's something that it's trying to teach us here. You have a very revealing parenthesis in the last of verse 3 and verse 4. You notice how it talks about Ahab summoning Obadiah. Then it tells you something about him. The writer puts this little parenthesis in. And Obadiah was one who feared Yahweh greatly. And when Jezebel cut off the prophets of Yahweh, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them by 50s in a cave and had sustained them with bread and water. That's very revealing. Obadiah, as it says, over the household. That means he's Ahab's chief of staff. He's the head administrator and so on. And he hides these prophets of Yahweh at great risk, really, to himself. These were prophets of Yahweh whom Jezebel, Ahab's nasty wife, was trying to wipe out and execute. And so Obadiah put them in a safe place, and he saw that they had daily provision and so on. It was a very risky thing. No one would need to tell Obadiah what would happen to him if Jezebel found out about what he was doing. It was a risky thing. It's interesting, isn't it? You have faithful servants of God operating undercover right where Satan's throne is. It's kind of hilarious in its own way. And encouraging as well. But there's a clear distinction here, seems to me. I don't want to press it too far, but Obadiah is very different from Elijah, obviously. Let's not get into a kind of a personality profile or something like that. But he's very different from Elijah. And don't put him down for his concern. You notice Obadiah has quite a long speech here in verses 9 through 14, really. After Elijah told Obadiah to go tell Ahab, look, Elijah's here. You've got to go meet him. And this just about unravels Obadiah. He says, look, you're going to have my head. You know, Ahab is not in for, he doesn't care for Elijah jokes anymore. And you mentioned that. He'll execute me because I'll tell him you're here, and then the Spirit of Yahweh will take you away somewhere, I don't know where, and he'll come and you're not here and he'll execute me and so on. And he goes into quite a long speech there. He's really concerned about it. You notice he mentions to Elijah in verse 13, you know, about his preserving alive 100 of Yahweh's prophets. Now you might think, oh, Obadiah is tooting his own horn there. No, he's not. Because the writer himself in verses 3 and 4 told us about Obadiah's courageous deed. So it's not that he's bragging. He's just telling Elijah the facts and so on. But he is concerned about his own self-preservation. Now don't get on your reader's high horse, as sometimes we can, and we say, oh, look at that. He's going to say he doesn't want to die, and so on. And as if we would despise him, and so on. No, that's just a very natural reaction. He doesn't want to be executed by the kind offices of Jezebel. He's concerned about that, and so he brings this up with Elijah. But don't you see, it took guts to do what Obadiah did. he's not the same servant as Elijah is. Elijah's a little bit different cut. Elijah is public and confrontational. Obadiah is more quiet, works behind the scenes, and yet he's faithful in the sphere where God has placed him. The Bible never tells us, you know, that there's only one kind of faithful servant. In fact, quite the opposite. 1 Corinthians 12, verses 4 to 6. Now, you don't have to be, let's say, an Elijah clone to be a faithful servant of Yahweh. Models are fine, but don't allow them to become a mold or a straitjacket in which you think you have to fit. You don't have to be an Elijah clone. I remember one time when, when we were living in Virginia for a year during a graduate school episode, and our oldest son was 3 years old, and we would have family worship or around the kitchen table, or it might be a time when we were having prayer before we ate and so on. And I might ask Luke if he wanted to return thanks. And as he closed his eyes to do so, he would contort his face up into the most awful looking thing. I can't imitate it. Now, some of you couldn't see that, and it's just as well. But it was horrid. And I thought, why does he do that? And he's going to return thanks. He's going to pray. But it's a horrid sort of a thing. And then I figured it out, as parents tend to do. Whenever I prayed, I noticed that I tended to wrinkle my forehead a bit. You know how you kind of focus to concentrate and so on. But I mean, I didn't go into all this stuff that he was doing, but I just did that, and I think that he thought, well, that's the way Dad prays. He kind of scrunches things up a little bit. And so he thought that he had to get himself into this terribly contorted facial expression. He had to fit into my mold. Well, you don't have to do that. You're not called in your service for Christ to engage in a kind of a Christian ape act of somebody else. You're not called to great works. You're called to good works. You're not called to a flamboyant ministry. You're just called to a faithful ministry. You don't have to fit somebody else's mold, but only serve Christ where he's placed you, which might be an Obadiah sort of affair. It wasn't too long ago at a meeting in the University of Virginia, the Christian group there, that a fellow by the name of Don Flo closed a lecture to a group by alluding to the story of a woman who bagged groceries in a supermarket. And over time, she chose to use her space at the end of the register to develop relationships with many customers that were passing through the checkout line. She was just bagging the groceries. But eventually, shoppers found themselves revealing their lives to her and actually gravitating toward her line while she bagged their groceries in order to interact with her. And as Don Flo said, God gave her 6 feet in life, and she owned it. The variety of God's servants. Now, secondly, notice that you have here the anatomy of God's ways. The anatomy of God's ways, verses 17 to 38. Now, this is going to take us the longest time to develop and look at. But let's get into it. A.W. Tozer wrote once these words: "The most portentous fact about any man is not what he at a given time may say or do, but what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like." That's the most crucial thing about anyone, Tozer says. Not what he at any time says or does, but what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like. So you have the anatomy of God's ways here in this section of chapter 18. Let's do a sketch. Let's kind of give an outline of God's ways and what it reveals about Yahweh as the true God as opposed to Baal. For one thing, it says that with Yahweh, neutrality is no option. You notice verse 21, Elijah challenges them. How long will you go on hopping between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him. And if Baal, follow him. And you might wonder, why was there such why were people of Israel drawn to this Baal worship? What was it that sucked them into Baal worship and so on? And just, by the way, I don't find this, and you won't find it in your Bible, but it seems like there are several appeals that Baal worship made. One was the appeal of royal sanction. It was what the government was in favor of. It's what Ahab and Jezebel pushed. And if you want some perks, and if you want to be in favor with the government, etc., Baal worship is the way to go. So it was a royal sanction. Another thing was that it had the appeal of tradition and history, because they could argue that Baal was the god and the deity that was worshipped in the land of Canaan for years and years and years, long before Israel showed up with the faith of Abraham and Moses. And so they could say, this is our tradition, this is what we've always done. There's also the appeal of need or relevance. Remember, Baal was the fertility god. That means that he would bring rain, etc., and prosper crops, which would produce their food, multiply livestock, etc. These were the things that were right down where the Canaanites lived. These were the basic matters of life. Baal worship scratched where they itched. This was relevant. This dealt with felt needs. That was Baal worship. And then, of course, there was the appeal of sensuality. Because sexual promiscuity had its place as a part of religious worship in Baal worship. Is your marriage rotten? Not to worry. You can go to the Baal chapel and you can hook up with a holy whore there and have your relation there if you want to. Baal worship, you might say, had as its watchword, serve Baal with gladness, all ye glands. So those are the appeals of Baal worship. Now you notice when Elijah says that neutrality is not an option with Yahweh, if Yahweh is God, follow him, and if Baal, follow him, that you notice his words carefully. He's saying that truth leads to discipleship. If you know who the real God is, then you follow him. You must follow him. It's not like a tractor-pulling contest at the county fair or something. You know who wins or something like that. And you say, Yahweh's then the real God. No. If he's the real God, then you follow him. Theology, truth, leads to discipleship. And that's what... There's no neutrality here. It's either or. And you do not have a tame God, Elijah says. He keeps slopping over into your life. He claims you. He demands your total devotion and worship. He refuses to allow us to put him into some sort of safe religion box. Or as if we can show him his deity litter, where he can go and stay out of our life unless we want him. None of that. You don't domesticate Yahweh. We walk away from him when we fall down and worship and give ourselves to him. But neutrality is not an option. And then another part of the anatomy of the true God, and that is that geography is no hindrance. Verses 19 and 20. You notice that it's Mount Carmel where this contest is to take place. That's up toward the northern part of the country of Israel, and you can see it on your Bible maps. The Mount Carmel is the part that kind of juts out in a west-northwest direction into the Mediterranean Sea. The highest summit is a little over 1,700 feet. It's about maybe 18 to 20 miles, the whole range, lengthwise, 3 to 8 miles wide, and so on. And apparently, it was a sacred area. We have Egyptian materials that refer to it as Holy Head. We have Assyrian materials that refer to it as Baali Rasi, Baal of the Promontory, or you could call it Baal's Bluff, perhaps. It must have been, and it quite likely was, turf that was sacred to Baal. That's interesting that Elijah should specify that the contest take place on Mount Carmel. That is, Baal will have the home court advantage. We're going to play this contest out on Baal's turf, so-called. If anybody can win, he ought to be able to win if it's his home court, and so on. But geography is no hindrance for Yahweh. And then activity is no inducement. That's another part of this anatomy. Notice verses 26 to 29. We'll be looking at that in a moment. But you notice the useless frenzy of the Baal prophets in 26 to 29 over against the earnest simplicity of Elijah in verses 36 to 38. It's quite a contrast. And the text is saying, activity is no inducement to Yahweh. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then notice that it's saying to us of this anatomy of Yahweh as well, that handicaps are no obstacle. You look at verses 34 and 35. Elijah gets his sacrifice ready after the failure of the Baal prophets, and he tells them to douse it, fill four jars with water, throw it on the sacrifice and on the wood. Tells them to do it a total of three times. You say, well, now I thought there was a famine in the land. Where are they getting that water? Well, there were springs on Mount Carmel. If the springs were actually ran dry, there's a pond called the Mediterranean Sea at the base there that's never evaporated, as long as we know of it. So there's no problem about getting water, even though there were famine conditions. And even Israelites knew, as we do, that wet stuff doesn't burn. It's as if Elijah is trying to make it as hard as possible for Yahweh, so that when he slurps up and consumes, this sacrifice, everyone will know that it had to be supernatural. So there's an overview of the anatomy of the real God. Now, I think we need to select one of these matters, and that is this whole matter of activity being no inducement to the real God to act. I want to draw your attention especially to verses 26 to 29 of what the Baal prophets are doing here. You notice you have this hyperkinetic display in verse 26, where they go for about several hours through the morning, "O Baal, answer us." And there was no voice and no one answering. And they hop around the altar and so on. And then at noon, Elijah mocks them in verse 27. And you notice he says, "Call louder, for he's a god." And then he says things that you wouldn't think would be true of a deity. But if you're in paganism, gods and goddesses in paganism just do the same sort of things that humans do, maybe on a little grander scale, but they do the same kind of stuff. And so when he says, "For he's a god," and he gives certain options about what Baal may be doing, this would be right up their alley. This would not be unusual to them, really. Well, he mocks them. You may say, I don't like what he says, but it's too bad he said it. He said, maybe he's thinking, he might be preoccupied, or he might be using the facilities. It may be that he's on a journey. One time in the Baal epics or myths, the Canaanite materials, there's a time when Anet, Baal's sister, and sometimes consort, comes to Baal's palace to see him, and she's told that he has gone out hunting. Maybe he's on a journey and he's not available. Or maybe he's asleep and needs to wake up. Nah, come on. No, that's true. We have pagan prayers. There's a prayer to the gods of the night. Why is it a prayer to the gods of the night? Well, because the gods of the daytime have punched out and they've gone to rest. And so you have to direct your prayer to the gods of the night, because gods, deities in paganism actually sleep. And if you think of that, it ought to change the way you look at Psalm 121. So here you have all of this and this mockery that he subjects them to. And so in verse 28, they call louder and they gash themselves till the blood flows out over them and so on. They rave on until the time of the evening sacrifice. In verse 29, there was no voice and no one answering and no one paying attention. Now, so this all gives way to this massive pandemonium on the part of the Baal prophets. And their blood pressure is just blowing out the roof, and nothing happens. Now, you may say, well, so why bring that up? Well, really because, you know, you might say, you know, I'm preaching to the choir. Well, choirs need to be preached to. So here we go. But you'll say that we don't carry on like those Baal prophets in 26 to 29. That's not the way we act. We don't have all that pagan hullabaloo. We don't gash ourselves and so on. We're not a bunch of pagan doofuses, you might say. Well, we may be more refined. But I think among God's people today in our land, there may be a certain Baal assumption operating in our thinking. What's the assumption of the Baal folks? That God will begin to do things if we just get a fever pitch of religious activity going. In the evangelical and the Protestant church, there's a sense in which I think there's an evangelical Baalism functioning today. It can be. Now, please understand, I'm not against these things, all right? So don't take this in the wrong way. But sometimes can't we sing things like this? God will surely work for us if only we are more consistent in our personal devotions, and devote our times to more intense and earnest personal prayer. Have 24-hour prayer vigils for different things in our church. If I join a personal accountability group or a small group Bible study, and if we start a visitation evangelism program, or if we have weekend marriage enrichment seminars, and don't forget that we need to have singles retreats as well. If we have neighborhood clubs for kids, and an early morning men's prayer breakfast or two, and mother's morning out. And we need to add another missions conference in there to stir that up. And add a mission trip to Iceland, because what have we done for Iceland recently? And get a bus ministry and have at least 6 buses and so on that have written on them, "We know where you are and we're coming to get you," or something like that. Get involved in parachurch ministries. Why aren't you involved in more parachurch ministries and so on? Get men to go to a Promise Keepers convention and get our youth to a ski trip in Utah and start a Christian drama group and have a watchdog group that deals with social and political issues. Oh, yes, if we just juice up our religion more, then God will. You may be. You may not be. You may not be a prophet of Baal, but you may think like one. Those can be all good things in a way. But you may be practicing Baalism under the banner of Christ if you think that you can get God to work just because you go into a hyperkinetic religious furor. So we have to pay attention to the anatomy of God's ways. Now, let me press you with one more matter here. Let's look at the sadness of God's victory. In verses 38 and 39, the sadness of God's victory. Now, this is not explicitly in the text, I don't think. But I think it's implied. And you may object. You may look at this. You may say, you know, we wouldn't have such trivial views of God today. We wouldn't have problems with recognizing the true God. We wouldn't have the indifference toward the God of the Bible today if he was doing the same kinds of things that he did on Mount Carmel back in 800-something B.C. You know, if you hear somebody talking about it, they might say, if God just did all that back there in Bible time stuff, then folks would really recognize. But I think you need to ask yourself, why did Yahweh do this? Why did he send fire on Carmel? Because his people either did not believe in him or were unwilling to confess him. And so he sent fire on Carmel. He went to this extreme in order to flush them out of their unbelief and indifference. It says something about their condition. It reminds me of the time in earlier teaching days when I was teaching at Belhaven College, university now, would teach a class about my favorite class to teach called Bible 220. It was called Old Testament Survey. It met three times a week at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was delightful because you had all sorts of people that didn't know anything about the Bible having to read the Old Testament narratives, and some kids who had been raised in the church that were probably reading them for the first time as well. So it was a delightful class. And the thing about the college at that time was there were no bells. You know, you've seen these things that sit on the wall, you know, in hallways, and they ring and shatter your nerves and so on. We didn't have any of those. You just went by the professor's watch. So it was very nice that way. And I would go down, perhaps get to class 5-10 minutes early, in case I wanted to put something up on the chalkboard and so on, get ready for class. And then at 8 o'clock, I'd open the class in prayer, and off we would go. I don't know what it was this one day. All the natives were restless. They were jabbering and talking, turned around in their seat, talking to each other. It was okay and so on. But I had done everything of my previous preparation I was going to do, and I was there. I had everything out. I was ready to go. It was 8 o'clock, and they just kept on. Somehow they just didn't recognize that I was there and we were ready to go, and so they would turn around and so on. So they just kept going. So I had enough of it. And so I very deliberately and yet suddenly and without any warning shouted, "Quiet!" And they turned around, picked their dentures off the floor, and as if to say, you could almost hear them say, "Oh, he's here." Now, I shouldn't have had to do that. You don't use extreme measures unless there's something wrong there. And that's what Yahweh is doing here. He shouldn't have to send fire on Carmel. If God must get dramatic to awaken us, then there's something wrong with us. There's something desperately wrong. You see, a miracle may not be a compliment. Quite the reverse. It's for those who are too dense to get the point. You see, faith is content without fireworks. What does faith say? Faith says things like this: I ask no dream, no prophet ecstasies, no sudden rending of the veil of clay, no angel visitant, no opening skies, but take the dimness of my soul away. That's a pretty good way of facing up to the real God. Triune Yahweh, you are the real God, and grant that we would follow you faithfully, boldly, unashamedly, and contentedly, for Jesus' sake. Amen.